Fascinating. Ryan is the Tech Connect project coordinator at the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority, and he is involved in planning, management, and evaluation of a SAMHSA-funded health information technology grant project. He received his MPH from Virginia Commonwealth University and has been actively working in drug and alcohol addiction research for over 5 years. So he can comment more on the alcohol abuse side of it. His research interests include behavioral health EPI, services, outcome evaluation, and the use of HIT for treatment outcomes.
Ryan. All right, so today we're going to talk generally about the program evaluation associated with the community-based crisis stabilization unit at the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority, but then we're going to get a little bit more specific and get into the chronic medical and substance use conditions that occur there. As already said, Kathy Tierney is here. She's sitting in the back, and she really deserves a lot of the credit associated with this, as she was the one who kind of got this up and running and put the evaluation instruments in here. Our other colleague, Jim May, who is not here right now, provided general oversight for the evaluation for this. So I have no personal financial or commercial interest to disclose, although I may or may not have tried to bribe a police officer to get over here. The general outline of this is that we're going to first start off by looking at the mission and overview, and then we'll move into some of the clinical and evaluation measures that are used within the CSU. We'll then actually get down into the data, and we'll look at some of the utilization, demographics, medical needs, some withdrawal scales, and smoking status. And then we'll end with looking at the future medical integration and evaluation efforts of the CSU. So the Richmond Behavioral Health Authority is where the CSU is located. It's located in downtown Richmond, Virginia, and it is the statutorily established local authority provider for mental health, substance abuse, prevention services, and intellectual disability. The services are provided directly to the citizens, and they're done by professionally trained and board-certified staff. Some other tidbits to give you an idea of what RBHA is. It has approximately 440 professional individuals. Most of them are located on one site, but they're also spread out amongst multiple community sites as well. Most of those sites are schools, but some are day treatment centers and vocational centers. They served approximately 8,000 individuals last year, which accounts for about 4% of the population of the city of Richmond. The overall budget for RBHA is about $38 million, but that excludes regional funding that comes in for some projects that are done in collaboration with the surrounding region. Moving on to the CSU mission, generally the CSU aims to provide a safe environment for consumers to receive evidence-based recovery services with regards to mental health, substance use, and medical services. It attempts to do this in an integrated manner, so as opposed to putting them into silos, which if you've been to other presentations, I'm sure you've heard the whole concept of siloing medical, siloing psychiatric. CSU attempts to merge those and provide them as an integrated effort. And then, since it does not exist in a bubble, it does attempt to work with the community partners in the region and surrounding area to allow for successful transition of the consumer back into the community. Just a general overview, this is a subacute unlocked residential setting. It provides voluntary admissions 24/7, 365 days a year. It has 16 beds, 7 of those are double, 2 are single. It's utilized by the surrounding region, and to date there are over 1,600 admissions, with 70% of those are uninsured. Every day that it's open, they provide recovery programming. They also provide daily psychiatric evaluations. These are either conducted by the nurse practitioner on site or through a contracted psychiatrist. They do provide medical evaluations 2 to 3 days a week, and that's done primarily through a internist who's contracted to come in and see the clients. They do provide medical detox from alcohol, opiates, and benzodiazepines, and they currently have approximately 23 full-time staff, ranging from peer specialists to the whole way up to the MD level. So right, what we have now are these are the key evaluation benchmarks that have occurred since the opening of the CSU. The first three occurred pretty much as soon as it opened, and those were the consumer suggestion box, the CWA, CALS, and Fagerstrom, which we're going to talk about a little bit later, and then some demographics and utilization data. As we all know, evaluation is an ongoing process. So as they move forward, April 2010, they put in 2 new instruments, which is the BASIS 24 and the perceptions of care. And then in September 2010, they underwent a dual diagnosis capability and addiction treatment review. I'm going to review some of these instruments right now because we're going to discuss them a little bit later, and then we're going to get a little bit more in depth with the C1 and the CALS. So the BASIS 24 is a proprietary instrument that comes out of McLean Hospital, which is a portion of Harvard University. It is designed to provide a quantitative measure of psychiatric burden, and it does this by using 24 questions that use a 5-point Likert scale. These are then combined to provide 7 subscales and 1 total global burden scale. It's designed to be a longitudinal measure, so it's done at intake and also done at discharge, which for our case is approximately 6 to 7 days. The perceptions of care is also out of McLean, but it is only done at discharge, and it looks at interpersonal aspects of care between the treatment team and the client. If you've ever seen like the Working Alliance Inventory, which looks at an individual provider and client relationships, you can kind of compare that to this, except instead of looking at one-on-one, it's looking at one-on-many. So some of the measurements of withdrawal that are used. The Clinical Institute Withdrawal Scale is a clinician-administered scale that looks at 10 withdrawal symptoms to create a global sum score. This score gives an idea of what the status of withdrawal is for the client. It goes from 0 to 8, which is that lower end, the minimal to mild withdrawal, up to 15 and above, which indicates severe withdrawal. The Clinical Opiate Withdrawal Scale, or CALS, is also clinician-administered. It looks at 11 different opiate withdrawal symptoms, and same as the CIWA, it has a lower end of the scale, which indicates mild, and a higher end of the scale, which indicates severe. If any of you have used this in the past, it is used somewhat to guide withdrawal and detoxification. However, for the CSU, it's primarily used as a screening tool and for evaluation purposes. And this is just to give you an example of what these things look like. So as you see a whole bunch of symptoms, signs and symptoms up there. There's Likert scales on the side. The clinician or case manager, whoever's assessing the client, looks at these, makes their assessment, and then they add them up to come up with a total scale score. This is the opiate withdrawal scale, and same as the previous measure. You have signs and symptoms listed, check boxes with scores associated with them. Once you come to the end of that, it's added up, gives you a total score. So when it comes to smoking status and dependence, they use the Fagerstrom test for nicotine dependence. This is a self-report, self-administered 6-item test that gives the clinician an idea of the dependency upon nicotine, and it ranges again from 0 to 2, which is your very low dependence, to your individuals with very high, who would score somewhere between 8 and 10. And this is what this looks like. Instead of the clinician doing this, the client is supposed to enter this information. So getting down into the data, I'm just going to point out a few things. So in 2009, we started off with 295 admissions and 257 unique individuals. We then have escalated quite a lot. Kathy is consistently busy now with 685 admissions and 442 unique individuals. Even though the numbers have gone up, the individuals completing treatment has stayed relatively the same. It started out at 88% and now it's moved on to 85%. The length of stay has stayed pretty consistent, with about a week is how long they stay. With the average daily census has gone up. So before, the average daily census was about 8. Then as things started getting going, it moved up to 11, and now it's about 12. And as you would see from the numbers, the utilization rate has gone up quite markedly from 2009 to 2012, going from 43 to 76%. The demographic data is actually collected from the BASIS. The BASIS has an entire demographic section associated with it. The majority of the individuals self-report that they are Black or African American or Caucasian, and then smaller minority indicate that they are American Indian, Asian, Native Hawaiian, or multiracial. Under the other category, you can technically put in something else. That data is not included in this presentation. It is almost a 50-50 split between men and women. So there's just some general outcomes, and if anybody's more interested in this, this has been presented at other locations, and we'll be happy to provide it to you. But when we look at those BASIS 24 scale scores and the perceptions of care scores, we see that they are comparable to the benchmark reports that the McLean University or McLean Hospital did when they initially released these instruments. We also see that decreased burden scores from admission to discharge across all of our BASIS 24 domains. Even though global is not listed, we also see a decrease in the global score as well. Individuals who have a co-occurring disorder, and this can be either be a substance abuse or mental health co-occurring disorder, tend to have higher burden scores at intake for their relationship and substance abuse scales compared to those individuals who do not have a co-occurring disorder. Moving on to our primary mental health diagnoses, the majority of them either fall into psychotic or depressive, where psychotic is primarily schizophrenic or schizoaffective. Depressive is your major depressive disorder. And then a lot of it's the not otherwise specified. And then we get into bipolar and then a mix of some smaller mental health diagnoses. When we move on to the co-occurring disorders, we see most of them fall under polysubstance abuse. What's not included in here, and we actually haven't run this analysis yet, is we do capture what substance they prefer. So one of the things we'll be running in the future is, so you have been indicated to have polysubstance. Which one of those substances is the one that you prefer? This is followed by alcohol, and then there's a steep drop-off for the remaining diagnoses where we have opioid, cocaine, ID, MH, and SUD. One thing to note is that when I say opioid, alcohol, and cocaine, this is a grouping of disorders, so it's not just alcohol dependence. This can be alcohol abuse, alcohol dependence, withdrawal, so on and so forth. Moving into our most prevalent medical diagnostic categories. So to start off, I just want to tell you how this data gets onto the spreadsheet, and then we'll look over this chart. The spreadsheet has two sources of medical diagnoses. The first source comes from the psych eval, which is done when the client comes in. So the client can self-report that they have disorders. That's written down, and it makes it into the database. On a parallel track, the internist, if they do see them, can also make diagnoses. One thing to make note about this database is that there's no redaction. So if, let's just say that the client self-reports some disorder, and then they see the internist, and the internist decides you don't really have that. There is not a mechanism right now where we're going back and taking that off of the sheet. So there is the potential here for some reporting of self-report false diagnosis. We are moving into the new EHR in 2013, so we will be able to begin to manage that system once that comes up and running. When we look at this, we see that most of them fall under hypertension, liver, and neurological, and then we have smaller groupings under cardiac, diabetes, and gastrointestinal. These classifications are not done by ICD-10 coding. This is kind of an in-house first-look program evaluation where the nurse practitioner groups them into these categories. One of the things that we're going to do as we move forward is begin to classify them according to the ICD-10. One of the things that didn't pop up here that I'm interested to see as this grows is when you look at Richmond just got named the second fattest city, go us, and we don't see, obesity did not come up as very prevalent. In fact, if I remember correctly, it came up as like 5-6%. Which is also different. We do evaluation throughout all the other mental health, substance abuse, and other divisions, and obesity is a higher thing that occurs there. So I will be interested to see as we as we move forward with this, if obesity will pop up forward. All right, so we're moving on to those withdrawal scales that we discussed before. Right now, we have somewhere between 129 and 130 individuals for this analysis. When we look at the means for these, the CEWA has a mean of 4.22, which puts that right around that low withdrawal point. CALS has a 2.64, again, low withdrawal. And then the Fagerstrom has 2.93, which indicates low dependence, which is surprising to us, considering that a lot of these individuals have high substance abuse burden needs and will often come to us potentially under the influence of something. But the thing to make note here is that when they do come in, these tests are given at intake. So the individual who was dropped off to the crisis stabilization unit may not have begun withdrawal, or they may just begin the withdrawal processes. So these low numbers may not be indicative of the true burden that they are feeling while they are at the CSU. One of the things that we're going to look at as we move forward is potentially moving these to separate time points to see if we start getting different numbers. Going into our primary care and medical integration efforts, some of these are occurring currently, but we are going to expand them. So right now, the daily medical assessments and teaching does occur, but we are going to look to expand that in the future. There is medical screening on all admissions, but we are going to attempt to add some more tests and potentially integrate that with some of the RBHA integration efforts. There is an internist on staff, but we are looking to potentially pool in a nurse practitioner. Virginia just released or just passed a law that allows for a nurse practitioner to operate off-site of the physician. So the physician doesn't have to work at the same location as the nurse practitioner. The physician just needs to provide oversight. When we go out to bid again, we will be looking for nurse practitioners to potentially provide services as well. And then, as always, we are looking to further collaborate and refer to our surrounding primary care providers. We have three FQHCs, a medical school about 7 or 8 blocks away, and a couple other local primary care providers that we are in the process of working with. And then there's some overall RBHA integration efforts that if you want further information about, there's a code at the end of this where you can download it. And this is looking at where RBHA is planning on moving as it comes to that bi-directional behavioral health and primary care integration efforts. So some of the future evaluation efforts that we're looking at, we are going to use the evaluation data to feed our service and program. We're going to look at some of the things we're doing well, what we're not doing well, how can we make improvements. We do want to look at how some of the service components affect different types of customers, so how do some of the components affect those with co-occurring disorders, those without co-occurring disorders, those with certain types of substance use disorders, and so on. We do want to look at how, a little bit more sophisticated analysis and look at how the perceptions of care or other diagnostic tools may relate to client outcomes. And then we want to really, really want to start getting into some of the return on investment and cost effectiveness research to start showing how cost effective this is as opposed to sending somebody to an inpatient psychiatric institution along with other things. And then the other thing that's not on here that we're very excited about is that we are going to get an EHR soon, which means that especially from the evaluation side, we now get to do a lot of data mining and things that were just not possible now, relatively simply, in the future. So we're very excited for that to kick in. This is just some of the citations for those instruments if you wanted some light bedtime reading to review them. And then these are some further recommended readings. And that is it. This is also the code if you want the other presentation. Any questions? So, right. So, like, where are they staying, and how, and what is their current housing status? The Basis 24 does have a section in its demographics that asks about their housing status. It's not particularly long, we have run that analysis in the past. If I'm remembering correctly, a majority of the individuals are either transient, or they are, you know, staying in someone else's location. They're not, or headed to or coming from a residential. They're not having their own apartments. They're not living in their own locations. One of the things we are looking to move to is potentially adding a housing status question that kind of gets, it's a little broader, that kind of, you know, so if they're homeless, you know, how often do they stay at a shelter? How often do they have access to certain things? If they're staying at somebody else's house, are they staying there consistently, or are they moving to different people's houses? We do want to get a little bit more sophisticated with that. But we do have those numbers, and we can send them to you.
My other question I have is,
So there are two things that we've considered, and we haven't gone too far down the path of exactly how we may do this. So we have the GIS route, where we can get the zip code, location, or track information, and begin to do that. And then eventually, if we could, I mean, it'd be nice to quantify the built environment. So if they're staying in a section of Richmond that is a very terrible built environment, how does that affect them as opposed to if they're staying in a place that does not? Those are both questions we would really like to get at. The concern then just comes to, you know, we have limited time and resources. How do we collect that information in a efficient manner for everybody, or for at least a substantive group of people? Yeah. And so that's something we're trying to work through.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a regular mental health issue. And then they go back to that. It seems like it might be good to know, like, if that person's going to go back to just the same environment where
right.
It's going to be conducive without just continuing, and then they're going to end up back to the typical kind of
a reinforcing environment, just
yeah,
send them back to us. Yeah, it's definitely something we want to look at. We are potentially going to experiment with it in a parallel project. So there's a project that exists outside of it that uses it's a technology grant provided by SAMHSA. And one of the things that we're looking at is the provision of cell phones. So we could potentially get GPS data from smartphones and begin to look at that. But it's not, we're still in the working process for that. Anything? We do both. So we have outside entities that we refer individuals to. So there's FQHCs, and there's a Virginia Coordinated Care Insurance group with the local university that people can be referred to. But there are also individuals on site. So within the CSU, there's the internist who comes in 2 or 3 days a week to do reviews of clients there. There's also something, I believe, in our mental health division where there's a nurse practitioner who comes in a few days a week to work with clients and begin to do those things. There is coordination. So within the CSU, when somebody comes in, there's an assessment of their attachment to the surrounding environment. So do they have a primary care provider within the community? If not, then you begin to look at places that they could receive services. So, you know, you can refer, we attempt to refer them out to the FQHCs, or if they already have the VCC insurance, we attempt to refer them out to those providers. And then that's all included in the discharge plan when they leave. There's no navigation, so like the individual's not being walked to the FQHC. We wish we had navigators, but, you know. It is part of the discharge process, and it is part of the planning process with the client. If we can, we do. Right now, we don't do that. I mean, the ideal is obviously to share, be able to do that, the sharing of medical records. So, like you give the provider a single login, and that person gets to see all the things that we've done with them. We are not there yet. Hopefully, eventually, we will be. But there is communication back and forth to those providers. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but the communication is there. Go for it. So I'm going to give you two answers. One of them is going to be my answer, and then I'm actually going to refer you to the nurse sitting behind you who can give you a better answer. The plan right now is so RBHA is attempting to move at this point to There's the thing called an FQHC lookalike, which is the step right before becoming an FQHC. And we are planning on definitely cross-training individuals to do these things. So, I mean, that's going to happen. As to whether or not, how to make them more comfortable, I mean, I don't have the best answer for that. Kathy may have some thoughts about that. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Okay.
For your data on the different assessments, you had about 129, 130. So not everyone, I'm assuming, gets an assessment, or was this a specific time period, or you have an N of like 400?
Right. So as you may have noticed as we move across, there are different N's that for the different assessment tools that we're using. As I said before, the evaluation is kind of it's a very much an ongoing process. So when Kathy first set these things up, she implemented these instruments and she got them going, and then the database came a little bit later, and then the evaluation staff came a little bit later as well. And so what you see right here with the 129, 130 is when this has started to make it into the database.
You probably have a lot more data.
We have much medical record abstraction to do. And then also we hope to add this into the EHR once it comes online, so that this is captured on a regular basis.
Okay.